Welcome to this edition of Environment Matters with me, Amanda Yorworth. Environment Matters is the show that brings you news on issues of sustainability and the environment from around the district and from further afield. And coming up later, can a pot plant really boost your maths? We'll hear about BRE's biophilic office project. And how is Oxfam in St Albans coping with the national crisis? Now, for the past decade, campaigners have been fighting proposals for a rail freight interchange on the old Radlett Aerodrome. However, Herts County Council have now offered up the land for a new scheme, this time accommodating 2,000 houses. What do the campaigners think of this? I spoke to Cathy Bolshaw of campaign group Strife to find out. Cathy, thank you very much indeed for joining me. Now, if I'd have told you about, 11 years ago, before this started, that 2,000 new houses were going to be built on the old airfield, what would you have thought?
Much the same as we thought about the proposal for the freight terminal, to be fair. It's greenbelt land, and the point is that we want to keep it as greenbelt land, and the objective was always, Strife's objective and reason for being was basically to keep that land as greenbelt land.
Right, okay. And so now, still with the possibility of the rail freight depot still hanging there, does that affect your ideas?
It does, in as much as, whilst we're obviously very pleased that, and we understand, we agree with Herts County Council and David Williams, the chief exec, of his agreement that it is, they would rather it stayed as Greenbelt as well. We do appreciate that obviously, there is land needed around the area for housing and there is a desperate need for that. So we appreciate that.
Right. So just from your first comments, do you think it is an appropriate place for, say, a new village or not?
It's difficult to say, and that's not really our place to say. We were set up to keep this, that piece of land, which is really the heart and lungs of southwest Hertfordshire. It is a big piece of greenbelt land between St Albans and really North London.
Right.
So we were always set up to say that it's not our place to say where the housing should be or shouldn't be. Obviously, as I say, we appreciate that there is a need for housing and that that could possibly solve some of that problem. Yes.
So ages ago, Kerry Pollard's suggestion was to have houses and then also incorporating perhaps some woodland, something like that. Do you think that might fulfil your requirements?
I think it possibly could, but of course at this stage in the game we don't know what those proposals are. There are no detailed plans at the moment, and that whilst they're talking about 2,000 houses and added other infrastructure, yeah, we don't know what that added infrastructure could be. Yes or no, it could be schools, it could be it could be doctors, it could be woodland, it could be greenery. I know it's supposed to be possibly a green village, but at this stage in the game we really don't know. And the thing is, it still would have other implications with regards to, particularly with traffic, where it is sited on the A414. That, as we all know, that 414 is heavily congested at the best of times now.
Yeah.
And although obviously it wouldn't have the HGV traffic that a strategic rail freight terminal would bring, it would have additional car traffic, which, and obviously of course that can't be monitored, which HGV traffic at least to some degree can be.
Yeah.
Car traffic obviously can't be, and most car traffic would be at the peak times as it is now, so would add to that, which the SRIFI HGV traffic would be more spread out throughout the 24 hours, if you see what I mean.
So. Right, okay. So actually some of the arguments that you had against the rail freight depot, the added traffic, actually are going to apply even with housing as well.
Absolutely. It's still pollution. It's still added pollution, and it's still going to be the added traffic implications. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay. So sound like it's not time for celebrations back at Strife HQ yet then?
Sadly not, no. I'd like to think so, but here we go, nearly 12 years and we're still fighting, so we'll keep going.
Well, that's right. And as you said, as far as any plans for housing, this is still very early days,
yeah,
so you're not willing to really sort of say whether you'd be in favour or not at this stage.
Not at this stage, as it is too early. As I say, we appreciate that there is a call, the call for sites, and we appreciate Herts County Council's position for doing what they've been asked to do. I'm proposing this land forward to St Albans District Council.
Yeah.
But it's still got to come out of Greenbelt. And whoever the developer is has still got to go through the planning process. They've still got to get over those very special circumstances to get it out of Greenbelt.
Right. Cathy, thank you very much indeed for joining me.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I was speaking there to Cathy Bolshaw of campaign group Strife. Now, the Buildings Research Establishment down in Garston have just started a comprehensive study into the benefits of adopting biophilic design principles. I spoke to BRE Research Director Ed Sutty to find out more. Ed, thank you very much for joining me. So why is this research being undertaken? I mean, what indications do we have that biophilic building design is important to us?
So I think the first thing to say is here at BRE we set the standards for sustainability in the built environment, and obviously people are a hugely important component of that, and particularly their health and well-being. If you think about, we spend on average 90% of our lives inside buildings, it's quite logical that what's inside those buildings and how they're designed has quite an impact on our health and well-being. So you know, that's the built environment section. And really, we're also aware that, you know, issues such as mental health and stress-related issues, you know, one in four of us each year in the UK suffers from a complication. And that seems to be increasing, primarily because of our coping strategies with stress and money and jobs and all those kind of issues. And again, that has a huge impact around the things that we work around and the buildings that we're in as well. So that's the sort of the reason we need to look at this.
Okay. And can the work in the environment that we're working in, can it actually make us better at work, as it were?
Yes. So if you think sort of quite broadly about health and well-being and our mental health, our social health and our physical health, all those three things come together to make us happier and more productive and energized individuals. So by altering the interior of a building, you can actually get a lot of sort of spin-off benefits in terms of, if you're an office, it's about communication, connectivity and productivity. If you're a healthcare environment, it can be around recovery rates. If you're an education establishment, it can be about educational outcomes. So the ability to change the interior of a building can have a direct effect on lots of very attractive qualities for different building typologies.
Okay, so all sorts of benefits there. So where will this study take place?
So the biophilic office is based at our campus on the edge of Brickett Wood. So we're very lucky in that we've got quite a wide range of estate of offices, and we're using it very much as a sort of an experiment, really. So biophilic design is a really fantastic umbrella that captures lots of very human-centric and natural qualities associated with buildings and environments.
What kind of things would those be?
Yes, so primary things that we can think of are things like natural light, around natural rhythm, artificial lighting, about air quality, colour, textures, sound, and indeed plants and interior connection to nature.
So that's really quite broad then, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Know, things like the noise I hadn't sort of considered.
Yeah, acoustic, hugely important. So basically, if you think of all the differences in what you're sensing when you're sitting in a building, which are often quite sort of sterile and plain environments, compared to when you step outside and all those sort of periphery things that you're hearing and feeling and seeing, you know, outside there's almost an infinite diversity in the natural world.
Yeah.
Yet we spend most of our lives in buildings that are really quite bland by comparison.
Okay. So how are you going to, you've named lots of different elements there, but how are you going to work out the effect of all these different things on people?
Yeah, so first thing to say is there's a very good body of evidence, of course, in scientific literature internationally about some of the individual qualities that we've mentioned. So that, for instance, the impact of daylight on humans and their health and well-being.
Yeah.
So what we're doing here is we're bringing everything together into reality, in a sense. So a real office that is refurbished, but you're quite right, lots of things are going on at once. So we're interested in the biophilic design strategy, which is partly about the products and systems that go inside the building, and partly about the environment and the design, and partly about the people. But we also have an element of the building that's a bit more like a laboratory, if you like, where we can change single things and look more closely at those individual related impacts.
Right.
So whether we change the light or whether we change the floor cover or the wall colour. So we can sort of distill it down a little bit more in that environment, as well as having the whole office building itself.
Okay. And it sounds quite complicated. How long do you think this research is going to take?
It is very complicated. When you start talking about sort of people-based studies, it's very complicated. So what we're doing, we started in November last year with monitoring what we call the baseline. So the building as it is now, both in terms of the indoor environment and the outdoor environment, but also the occupants. So that solid baseline for a year, because we have to, you know, with people, we all feel a little bit brighter perhaps in the summer than in the depths of winter.
Of course,
so we have to get a really solid long-term data set before we can then intervene with the refurbishment and then monitor the indoor environment and the people again. So we're looking at sort of 2.5 years, roughly, for the whole project.
Okay. And what do you hope to create as a result of this research? What will the outcome of it be?
So our prime focus is on the sort of practical interventions that office owners can implement now to improve health and well-being, and obviously recognising that some of those people are on quite limited budgets. So we're very interested in those sort of practical interventions, so providing that guidance that will help people make more health and well-being decisions when they come to refurbishing or refitting an office is a primary target. And we're also interested in whether we can encourage more people to get engaged in designing and developing products for health and well-being. So that might be thinking about a floor, that might be about the colours on walls, or it might be about the office furniture.
Okay. And do you think this will have any relevance to, I mean, you've talked about this in the office environment, will this have relevance to us at home?
Yes, it will. So you're right, this is an office, and health and well-being of occupants we know connects then into communication and productivity and just happier workers, effectively. But equally, some of those qualities will transfer to other building typologies, so healthcare and education. And indeed, in the home, the home's quite an interesting one, of course, because the key thing around health and well-being is that we're all individuals and we're all different. So actually, we all have slightly different perceptions around environmental conditions inside buildings. So to sort of design and develop in an office is relatively straightforward. But then for a home, there's lots of sort of personal occupant behaviour things that need to be overlaid a bit more. But having said that, I could certainly see it transferring to, for example, social housing, where an organisation might have a larger stock of homes.
Yeah.
So there's absolutely some of the qualities will transfer, yeah.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like fascinating research, Ed, and we look forward to hearing what you discover.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. And I was talking there to BRE's Ed Sutty. Now, we've heard on the national news about the shocking revelations about Oxfam. Well, here in St Albans, we've got no less than 3 Oxfam jobs. I went down to see how one was faring. So I'm here in St Albans Fleetville Oxfam shop talking to Pat. Hi, Pat. How long have you been volunteering for Oxfam for?
22 years now.
Really? And has your attitude to Oxfam changed over the past few weeks?
No, it's not. I'm still a firm believer in the work that Oxfam do.
Yeah?
And, you know, supporting lots of countries, lots of people in the world.
Yeah. So as far as you're concerned, you're still doing a great job here.
We are, yes.
Absolutely. And have you seen a drop in the donations that the shop's receiving?
Yes, the last few weeks we've not had as many
donations
as we usually get. But
right. Has anybody said anything to you?
No, nobody's mentioned the other affairs that are going on within Oxfam.
Okay, so a slight effect, but you still think you have some loyal customers there?
Yes, we do.
Okay, and do you feel that the shop is doing important work here?
We are. We're recycling by selling the things that we get.
Yeah.
So they aren't going to landfill.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, I mean, we're here. Yeah, we just had somebody coming in with a donation of a little mug here, still in the box, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
That's tragic to think that would go to landfill.
It is. If there weren't shops like us to sell them, they would go to landfill.
You were just telling me about a volunteer from Spain. What did she say?
Yes, I did ask her if they had any charity shops over there.
Yeah.
And she said no. Anything that they didn't want anymore, it was just sent off to the to their rubbish tips, to their landfills.
Yeah. And of course, if donations didn't come to shops like yours, that would be happening here as well, wouldn't it?
It would. It would.
And of course, the being able to offer things a little cheaper for those with a bit less money as well.
Of course, yes.
Yeah. Which is...
Yes, which is... I'm one of them.
Yeah?
Yes, and we do get some really, really nice things in.
Yeah.
Lovely things. So
yeah, so a good place. And also, I suppose we're worrying more about plastic waste, aren't we?
We are, yes. So I don't know what will happen to that, you know.
Yeah. But of course, you're recycling.
Yes.
Synthetic clothes.
Yes.
Plastic toys.
Plastic toys, lots of them, yes.
Yeah. So all good work keeping plastic out of the oceans, keeping the dolphins happy.
Hopefully, yes. Indeed. Yes.
So what's the message that you'd like to give to anybody out there unsure about whether to bring donations into Oxfam?
Please do. You know, we can sell most things that you bring in. Anything that we can't sell, we will recycle.
Yeah.
And as you say, you know, lots of people can't afford to buy the shop goods, so they can come in here and find, you know, lots of nice things.
Excellent. Well, Pat, keep up the good work here. 22 years and still going.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And I was talking there to Pat at Fleetvale, Oxfam. So until the same time next week, thank you for listening.